This is the real weepy and like tragic part of the story beginning, oh my brothers and only friends.
I'm in for four potential getaway drivers. Go.
No!
But I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume.
No!
Excuse me, we have a little bit of a hurry.
Hang on, Voltaire.
It's yet another long series of diversions in an attempt to avoid responsibility.
We are finally back with This Just In after a bit of a hiatus, and for those of you who are wondering about the awfully convenient connection between our discussion of World of Warcraft addiction and the sudden slew of missed episodes, well, don't get ready to close the case just yet. We actually have valid reasons for our absences, most notably Chris's mouse completely busting, and the program last week we used to record going absolutely haywire. Naturally, the extra time we had in our hands due to these problems was not spent creating a better show for you, but in leveling up our characters. As for your host, I'm Tanner Higgin, a level 22 rogue, podcasting from Los Angeles.
And I'm Chris View, a level 22 tauren shaman, podcasting from Detroit.
Bullsh, you are not level 22. What level are you again? 18?
18, yeah.
And the best thing is you have a loincloth. I think that's the key aspect of your character is you're essentially wearing furry like briefs.
Yeah, and I'm enormous too. I'm this huge cow looking creature and I wear a loincloth and I run around randomly healing people.
And this is not a joke. We actually have missed the last couple shows for legitimate reasons, as opposed to the other reasons when usually we just have nothing to talk about. We actually have been experiencing a few technical difficulties, but hopefully things
and
are...
And for the past week, I've had the plague. Literally, I've given it at least to one other person, two people now. My dad's got it, and this other friend of mine has it. Unfortunately, for the other friend of mine, she does performance, you know, she does musical shows and plays, and like I swear it happens is you lose your voice, so therefore no podcast on this guy's end. And then the second thing that happens is like in the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade thing, you become a zombie. It's like drinking from the you choose poorly cup of Christ. And so yeah, right now I'm basically a frail human being.
That's such a great scene in that movie too. Where he drinks it, and I think there's a pause where he thinks everything's gone well, and then all of a sudden he just turns into, like, a skeleton.
Well, like, it's cool because, like, he thinks it's gone well, and then he does this, like the musical director of the film, like, does this, like, weird chime, like, doom, 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 like, this off note. You're like, oh, shit, something's gonna happen. And then he grabs onto Elsa. Like, my last move, if I was gonna turn into a skelly, would be to, like, grab onto someone and show them what it looks like. Right in your
I think what I would want to do is like punch a wall and just see my like arm disappear into dust or something.
And enough with that talk.
All right.
What's our first topic?
Well, you had brought up that you'd wanted to discuss the practice of circumcision and how you've suddenly begun to question if you would do it for your own kid.
Yeah, the reason why I thought of this topic was because I was watching Penn and Teller's Bullshit, because I've been trying to clear those out of my hard drive. They're taking up too much space. I was watching an episode on circumcision, and as I was watching it, I guess I was on the fence in the first place coming into the show. It's not like I was so pro-circumcision that it, you know, I would do it without question. I had thought about it in my head whether or not I would do it for you know, whoever my future child is, if it's a boy. And and
or a girl, you know.
Gross, no way. That's just general.
She cannot experience pleasure.
I'll ship her over to Africa and I'm watching the show and I'm becoming more and more disgusted, not only because of what these doctors are saying. Some of these doctors are saying things about how the benefits of circumcising a child, that it's you'll experience cleanliness, it's easier to manage, and whatever. You know, they have all these arguments for it. And I was like, okay, yeah, whatever. And then they showed the arguments against, And I was pretty much swayed by the arguments against, because on their end, they argue cleanliness. They use cleanliness as one of their arguments, which I thought was an interesting thing to bring up, considering one side's using it for their own purposes. The other side, the ones who are saying don't circumcise, are saying that, you know, that the protective sheath is just that. It's a protection against those types of viruses. And anyway, and then I think what was most disturbing to me, and I'm usually not alone, but in this case I was the graphic videos of children being circumcised, and it just looks very unnatural. And it's such an archaic thing anyway. I mean, the purpose of it does span back to Judaism, and it was like basically a pact made with God to cut off the tip of your kid's ween, you know, to show that you're willing to sacrifice that.
Yeah, but isn't there arguments out there that of course there's there's reasons for it written in, you know, Jewish lore or whatever, but it serves a function, and that's why it was written into their religion, you know?
Yeah, but
isn't that
the
argument?
Function?
Yeah, that's what I always thought that it was just so much cleaner, and that there was problems with it back in the day, and that they were just, you know, as with all aspects of religion, where it's an aspect of control in some sense,
right?
You know, we need to control this. So.
I could probably say that the cleanliness aspect would have been pertinent 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And so for them to say, like, yeah, you know, it's probably good to cut off the tip of the kid's cock, it's probably a good idea, especially get it done with at an early age so he doesn't have to experience. But the Jews, I don't think, did it at an early age. I still think that they hold to the tradition that you do it, you know, at your bar mitzvah, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Not all kids, but, you know, if you're Orthodox, I'm sure that's the case. Email me if I'm wrong. I'm spouting out of my ass the knowledge I have, so. But nowadays, and Penn Jillette brought this up, you know, it's not like we lived back then. There are soaps and things that you can use to clean that.
Yeah.
So the argument for cleanliness, I think, is moot. It doesn't seem to be applicable anymore. So, and so if that's the case, if we can take cleanliness off the table, what other purpose does it serve? Because as far as I know, taking the hood off of it is also desensitizing the tip of the penis for sexual acts, which sucks. You know, that's stupid. I'm kind of upset about that then. And then, what else is there? I'm trying to think of
the
what
only,
other arguments there are.
The only reason people do it is because they think that the kid is somehow going to get ridiculed. You know,
right.
The mythical gym wherein everyone's, like, displaying their penises to each other. But
right. And I think that's the only argument now that can be brought up. And it's the only valid one, I guess, because it has become the status quo. And the social norm is that men are circumcised. And so, and I've talked to various women on this since I've watched the episode, and even they are inherently disgusted by the concept, the better word is they're bewildered by it, because they've never experienced it, most women haven't, and
yeah,
almost afraid.
Yeah, I don't think that disgust is probably the right word, that they're just nervous about it, because they don't understand it, because so many people are circumcised. So I guess, in that sense, it does... It would probably make the kid more nervous about what he's got going on under there, just because he would be outside of the norm. But
yeah, and I think almost it's become a self-fulfilling event, because the reason that I would even question whether or not to do it, because all these things considered, I would probably say do not mutilate my kid's genitals. It's just... Not to mention, just to go off on a quick tangent, but there's a study that shows that children, contrary to popular belief, they feel pain to a degree more than you or I do. They're more sensitive to pain. Their nerves are still, you know, they're budding, but they still feel a more amount of sensitivity, especially, you can only imagine, in one's penis.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids, when you see them screaming, it's not just like a weird response. It's actual, like, they're cringing in such pain, and that's why they have to tie these kids down when they're doing it.
The scream is horrible too, because I actually saw, because congruent with your watching this episode, I saw I think it was like on Home and Garden television or something, they had. Where these people were throwing a circumcision party, where they had a Moyl, you know, the Jewish, I guess.
Don't get me started on Moyls.
Yeah, he's like a, they're sort of a priest who just does circumcisions or something like that.
That's all they do is touch kids' genitals. It's kind of disgusting if you ask me.
And so they had, I don't even think, this is the weird thing, I don't even think they were Jewish. And they threw one of these parties and had a Moyl come. And everyone, and it was bizarre to see this on Home and Garden, because everyone, you know, was around having the party, and they're concentrating on how this party's going and everything. Then all of a sudden the Moyl comes, they lay the kid out on, like, the kitchen counter, and he circumcises it, and the kid is just screaming, and it was, like, this horrible scream, and you could see the faces of everybody in the party, like, suddenly turn into, like, disgust and horror. And then it was over, and then the kids shut up, and everyone's like, yay! But it was, to me, I mean, it really made me think twice about the whole thing.
Well, on this show, and again, Bullshit isn't necessarily the most credible show, because they
it's extremely biased.
but they showed a kid afterwards, and it was effective, based on what I'd seen that whole episode. They showed a kid afterwards with his penis tied up. And I think he had just finished, you know, getting his stuff done. And he was kind of sitting there, and he looked... He had, like, the thousand-yard stare. He just got back from Nam. And, you know, he was really messed up, you know. And Penn... There's actual medical term for this, and Penn said it. I don't remember what it was. But the medical... he basically was in some sort of post-traumatic... Like, he went through so much trauma that he was shocked, you know, by what happened. Anyway, it killed me. But anyway, that's the tangent I wanted to go off on. What I was trying to get at, though, was that the only from doing this for my kid is that since I am circumcised, I wouldn't know how to really deal with the kid. You know, it's like, since I wouldn't know what to experience with him, it'd be hard, at least at this stage in my life, to be like, hey, Junior, here's how you clean the end of your dick, you know? I wouldn't know. It seemed to me, at the end of, when the episode was all said and done, regardless of whatever slant they have, it just seemed like there isn't really a modern application to this procedure. There isn't a reason, except for that it's become the social norm. And yeah, like you said, that mythical locker room experience where if my kid comes home and he's crying and he's like, yeah, they made fun of my penis. I guess I would say, like, I would be more willing to deal with that than I would be to just live with the fact that I mutilated authorized the mutilation of my kid. It kills me. But there is restoration. You can restore it. At the end of the episode, they show the 60-year-old doctor who's been restoring his own foreskin. It was the most, I will say, aesthetically, it was the most disgusting cock I've ever seen. And in this guy's case, what he had done was he had attached weights and stuff to the skin, he had, for like the past 5 years, had been pulling the skin gradually, and it looked like, it looked like a rigged up foreskin, I'll say that, but it was so disgusting. And they show it for like a minute, and then he puts this contraption that like pushes the head of your penis up into the skin, and it's like this ball, it's this metal ball that like goes in there, and then the skin fits around the ball.
I picture his penis looking like a tremor.
Like a what?
A tremor from the movie Tremors.
But yeah, it was a gross. It was so gross. Anyway, so if any listeners have their own, I'm not going to say one way or the other what my opinion is. I will just say that it, based on all the evidence I've seen, it just doesn't seem like it's necessary anymore. So if anyone has good feedback of why we should do it, and I would prefer it if it was more scientifically based, not faith-based, only because, you know, the faith-based reason, I'm not going to be able to argue against it, or I'm not going to be able to say it's right or wrong. I mean, if that's your faith, that's what you guys just do by practice. But if you have a valid reason why we should or shouldn't do it anymore, please send it in. We'll read it on the next show.
The next topic was, I attended a lecture here by this woman, Angela McRobbie, who I had never heard of prior to the lecture, but she's a professor at Goldsmiths University of London in media and communications, and she, I guess, is one of the more prominent scholars in cultural studies in terms of feminism. And for a while, I've kind of become...
Feminist.
Yeah, I've become kind of disenchanted with feminism, though, because of...
Uh-huh.
the way in which the arguments are staged seem to be so antiquated and not like most people who masquerade as feminists are going are basically armed with sort of a 60s and 70s, you know, arsenal of tools, you know, and that time has passed. A lot of victories have been won, and it seems like a lot of people aren't retooling themselves to adapt to the modern landscape and the modern problem facing feminists, mainly people arguing that the victory has already been won and you don't need to do anything further, which is absolutely not true, because there's no gender equality yet. Mm-hmm. And she basically came up with this concept of post-feminism, and you know what it means to feminism today, you know, how things have transformed and what feminists need to do now to, you know, to combat the way things are going. And her argument is that essentially feminism has become common sense, where, you know, everyone just thinks that the battle has been won and that, sure, there's women's rights, you know, blah, 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 okay, you know, everything's, you know, fine, let's move on, you know, and it's become part of common sense. And she says that the feminist movement has sort of been absorbed into the state and into production and capital and that sort of thing. And to this end, she started theorizing about what's called the post-feminist masquerade. And I guess the best example of this would be Sex and the City, where you have these women who ostensibly are feminists, who are like fighting, you know, for feminine rights, and who are like fine examples of independent women, you know. But all their independence really is them getting jobs and becoming productive members of society, in that they get jobs, they become part of the economy, and then they just spend money in that economy. So all they become is basically puppets and cogs in the greater system. You know, they have no real independence. They basically have been, you know, retooled and reprocessed to become part of the system, as opposed to being the radicals that feminists were supposed to be, you know. And I thought that this was absolutely crucial to make this argument now, because there's all these women out there watching Sex and the City and reading these chick lit books thinking that this is empowering, when all it's empowering them to do is to obsess over finding men and buying shit. Which yeah. is completely not the goal, that should never be the goal of any woman. You see what I'm saying? You see her argument at all, or am I not making any sense?
You're making a valid point, and I have two came to mind while you were doing this. And the first was, and I don't know if this was her who wrote it, but I think 2 months ago in the Playboy forum section, they had a woman speaking about the perils of this new feminism, and it's similar to what you were saying, but her focus was on the political side, saying, you know, where women are placing their interests and how they're fighting battles that they shouldn't be fighting anymore, or that they're looking in the wrong realm to be fighting, and they're just making a bad name for feminism. I wish I could find the article right now, but I can't. Mm-hmm. But that came to mind, so if anyone knows what that is, let me know. But the second thing, and it's an argument I get in often, but it's something that I was discussing with a friend of mine the other night, and it's in regards to the consumerism aspect of women, which I find particularly interesting in her argument, where women are, like you said, they're cogs now. They're merely just, and they're allowing themselves to be chalked up just to that. And I think the prime example, at least here in America, I'm not sure what point she brought up about women in the UK, at least here in America, one of the major facilitators of that mindset is Oprah Winfrey. What she, you know, and she takes these women and she spouts off as like the preface to what she does is, we're women, we're liberated, you know, so let's do what women do. And then in the next breath, she's like, let's buy things, let's do this. And it's not effective. It's not, what it's doing is it's actually like it's regressing all mm-hmm. those rights that they want. It's making them into some sort of it's like the bane of some people look at it and they go, wow, that's your typical woman. And that's not what, like, feminism should be bringing to light all the ills and the perils of our current system and how it makes women set up to earn less and makes women set up to not get certain jobs or whatever the case may be. And instead, it's taking that and making it into this crude, bastardized thing where are not, they're becoming the butt of their of this joke, and it's stupid. It's stupid that they would even allow this to happen, or that they would be blinded by this mindless consumerism that people like Oprah are promoting. And so you see these women who, you know, they want certain rights, but or that they would like to say that they're for or against certain things, but instead what they do is they just they get bottlenecked into, like, this is a woman. A woman is someone who buys this type of book, shops at this type of store, controls her man in this type of way, and it makes for a regression in whatever fronts feminism has had victories on. And I don't appreciate it, because I like feminism. I'm all for the equality of all people, and I just wish that there was a way that they could get their shit together and not be. So I don't. It just seems like things have become convoluted, and that the front that they were once fighting on, they had once certain things into this anti Roe v. Wade thing, this anti hands off our bodies thing. Where, and I think they're being duped. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that they're stupid. I just think that they've kind of forgotten what it is that they should be looking after. You know, their interests are just not being looked after anymore, and people like Oprah don't help that out at all.
Yeah, because feminism won the right and the opportunity to generate income and capital and get jobs, but now they've been convinced that, you know, by the state, that the only way they can become useful or exercise their feminist, you know, power is by then spending this money as, like, in some display of, hey, we won this, we're going to, you know, exercise it. But that's not. Feminism should continue to be a radical movement that challenges the very structures that are encouraging people to become these mere, you know, spendthrifts.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous, and Sex in the City is dangerous, Chick Lit is dangerous, and people need to start recognizing this and refusing it and coming up with a different model, because it is. I mean, this Paris Hilton Sex in the City bullshit is actually regressing the movement, I think. Let's do the reader mail, I guess.
Okay. Well, let's see. Let me pull it up here. We received mail from our buddy Jason. He's an avid listener of the show, and he's always thoughtful in what he brings up in regards to what we say. So, first off, just let you know, Jason, we appreciate that you at least take the time to write such cogitative responses. But in regards to our Donald Rumsfeld discussion about him not using his email, Jason brought up some good points, albeit not necessarily argument swaying points for me, but still good points in regards to Rumsfeld not using email. So I'll read it. Hopefully I can read it well. Let's see. He says, in regards to your discussion about Rumsfeld and other White House officials not using email to communicate, I think there's more to consider than what you guys laid out. You know, I hate these goons as much as the next guy, so it pains me to produce an argument that works in their favor, but I've read before that it is a standard form for presidents and other officials to stay away from email for various reasons, or technology-type things. The biggest is probably that under the Freedom of Information Act, any email correspondence they produce, even personal, using a government email address can be requested at any time. Of course, anything that is a matter of national security shouldn't be included in an email anyway, but you never know. If anything I wrote could be made publicly available like that, I think I would shy away from it too. Also, it is far too easy for an email message, or the information contained within, to be passed on to more than just the intended recipients. I was out at a security conference last week talking to a guy that works for Microsoft, and he commented about how any time Steve Ballmer or Bill Gates sent out a mass email, even to a privileged group, its contents were usually shot or digged before all the intended recipients had even opened it. Besides, if Rumsfeld did have an email account, I would put money on the fact that his password would be God password or Rummy, and it would immediately be broken into. So thank you, Jason, for that. And, you know, after reading it again, I said that they weren't very argument-changing, but I guess it does kind of change the perspective of it. If I were a top dog in the government and I were writing some sensitive emails, there's venues you can use to send it over secure email, and there are ways, just like going into a secure phone line, but I think I would stay away from it. not just for security reasons. I think I'd be very selfish about it and say for mere political reasons, because if I were to ever do something devious, which would be likely because I always use my power for evil, I would probably end up shown across the country. And just like Bush this last week when he got fucked, royally fucked for his comments on Katrina, and then when that video came out of him hearing about what would happen if the levees broke, like 2 days before they did, you know, that kind of stuff is damaging. So, you know, it would be just my luck that, you know, here I am trying to siphon millions out of the company coffers, and then I say it once in an email to some random broad I'm having an affair with on the side, that, you know, well, you know, it would be upsetting to me if that happened way of email. So I guess Jason's right in that respect, but the same time, I still think it's crucial that they have some way to be instantly connected.
Yeah, I mean, the Freedom of Information Act, it's not as easy as it seems to get information. You know, having worked in the government and being a publications person, I understand the Freedom of Information Act, and we've had to use it. You know, we've had people try to collect stuff from us, but we'd say no because it's protected under, you know, proprietary information, or it's classified, or this and that. There's a lot of ways you can get around giving out information. And, I mean, the government has a lot of measures set up to protect electronic communication, you know, with internal security systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, with
exactly.
That whole card system where you have a personal identity card you got to stick in your computer, and then they have a secure, you know, intranet, whatever they call it, thing that you know, encodes all messages sent over.
Cipranet.
Yeah, and you've got to have certain rights to be able to access certain emails. I mean, they've got measures set up to protect that sort of stuff. I mean, I still don't think there's any excuse not to at least, you know, use it for casual correspondence. I mean, if you've got highly sensitive stuff, of course you might want it carried by a person, or, you know, that sort of thing. Or right. Over a secure phone line, but
yeah, exactly. And that, like you said, they have the measures in place. They're not idiots.
Like,
for instance, at the Department of Defense, they're not morons when it comes to their security. They have you can send secure faxes. You can have a secure phone conversation. You can send secure emails. You just have to have the rights and accessibility to those things. And not everybody has those, but those people who are at the top certainly do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the people who need to see the information typically are the ones who will be seeing the information. It's not that easy to hack into, as far as I know, because as of yet, there hasn't been that much. I mean, the office I'm working in now, we deal with those emails, and I have yet to see anything in the news where, you know, where anything that I'm looking at, any of this information has been leaked to somebody. It's going to the appropriate parties, and, you know, the only time it could potentially be leaked is if it gets into the hands of, which is kind of, it happens, but someone who's in Iraq, who's got the clearance to receive the message, and they tell it to your average GI in the field, and then that information can get home, and that's it. But it's so convoluted that path, you know, it rarely happens. Mm-hmm. And we're not even talking about that type of sensitive information. We're talking about correspondence between Rumsfeld and Bush, or somebody, you know, calling Rumsfeld, getting Rumsfeld on his BlackBerry really quick while he's out golfing. I'm more worried about the quickness of the response of these people, not necessarily what they're saying personally to one another.
One last thing I wanted to talk about was in issue one of The Means, we had sort of a feature interview and a cover done by this guy named Jeffrey Brown, who's, you know,
fantastic.
Yeah, it's hard to describe him. He's a graphic novelist, I guess you would say. He draws comics, but he does them in novel form, and they're usually based around relationships and that sort of thing, semi-autobiographical. And he's also done some superhero parody and whatnot. I first encountered him through an issue of McSweeney's that was dedicated completely to comics, edited by Chris Ware. And out of everyone in that issue, I found his stuff the most interesting. So for issue one, I just, you know, said, what the hell, I'll try to contact him and see if he'll do it. And he ended up being extremely accommodating and more than willing to give an interview and do a cover and ended up sending me, you know, some free books and a signed little print and all kinds of stuff. And he was just an amazing guy. And you know, I like to feel like the Means and McSweeney's discovered him. And and now it's really cool to see him actually getting some due and starting to you know, come into his own, because as I was corresponding with him and asking him to do the cover, he was like, you know, I'd do it for free, but now I'm actually trying to make money from comics, so if you guys can send me any money, that would be nice, which of course we did. But it's now nice to actually see him making some real money from comics. And I was on the site of his publisher, Top Shelf Comics, which is at topshelfcomix.com, and they had a little story that he is now, as I guess the band Death Cab for Cutie, which I'm sure most people know, they're coming out with some DVD, I guess, which is going to have a video for every one of their songs on their new album. And he's actually, and Jeffrey Brown is actually, his comics are being used for one of the videos.
That's
and,
awesome.
And being animated by somebody else. And it's for the song Your Heart is an Empty Room. And so he did the whole video for that, and the DVD is called Directions, the band's Death Cab for Cutie. So that's pretty awesome that he's doing that, and the Means is has been one of the places that he's been discovered in.
Yes. And that comes out April 11th, I think it says here.
April 11th. And I guess he's, you know, the bastard is coming to California, but he's going into Northern California. He's not stopping in Southern California.
Do you know when he's coming?
See, he's going to be in San Francisco on April 8th and 9th.
Wait, I'll be in California April 8th and 9th.
At the Alternative Press Expo. April 7th, he's going to be Atlantis Fantasy World. It's in Santa Cruz. And he's going to be doing another signing on April 8th in San Francisco at Giant Robot.
We should. And a trip. I'm not even kidding. A trip. I have unlimited miles on that rental car I'm getting. So we should plan a trip up to San Francisco. Say hi to Jeffrey Brown. Just wave. Just get up in line. Be like, hey, and then leave. And then, like, as we leave, though, like, we'll throw an issue of the Means at him. Be like, that's us. And then leave. I'm serious. I would love to see him, though. If I can get this interview done with Stephen Pressfield, aka X Press. If I can get that interview done with him. Early on in my trip out there, I say, screw it, man. Me, you, Katie, and Amber can make a trip up to San Francisco. That would be awesome.
Are you prepared for how intensely boring that drive is?
I am prepared. It is, I will bring a flask.
It is 6 hours of like, nothingness. Like, orchards of apricots and Jack in the Boxes and Carl's Juniors. That's all it
Carl's
is. Like, it's just empty. It's so boring, that drive.
But sure, we could get up at 6 in the morning, be there by noon. We could get drunk on wine, waltz into whatever bookstore he's at, and then have him sign our issues of the Means and Miniature Sulk, and then call it a day. Go see the Bay Bridge. Maybe take the tour of Alcatraz.
Man, that would be cool to have him sign issues of the Means and, you know, give them away as prizes or something.
Hell yeah. He would do it. You know he would.
Mm-hmm.
I say we do it. I don't know. It all depends. I have to contact X Press and figure out how the hell I'm going to get out to his palatial Malibu estate early on in my trip.
At this point, you're just trying to name drop all your new celebrity friends.
You know Stephen Pressfield, the hit author of The Legend of Bagger Vance and The Gates of Fire and all
both options. One made as a movie, the other optioned as a movie.
You know, they have a whole thing on his website, too, about that. About the let me see if I can see. So much buzz about Gates of Fire becoming a movie. And I remember in 1999 this buzz being in existence. And I remember them saying that the script was some 240 pages.
Oh, my
and that
God.
The last, like, I think I want to say the last 90 pages, meaning the last hour and a half, but, I mean, technically the last hour and a half, but very little dialogue in that 90 pages, all action, all the last battle at Thermopylae. So you can imagine, that would be, if you're doing all stage directions for 90 pages, no dialogue, That's literally 90 to 100 and some minutes worth of film, just pure action and war. I mean, I can't even imagine that.
I can't imagine writing that script where, like, you know, Persian number 46 gets stabbed in gut, you know.
Yeah.
Spartan number 5 gets decapitated.
Here's the frequently asked questions on X-Press's website. Will there be a movie of Gates of Fire? And this is the most frequently asked, and here's the answer. Gates of Fire has been under option to Universal Studios since it was first published in 98. The acquiring production company was George Clooney and Robert Lawrence's Maysville Pictures. A number of scripts and revisions have been written for them, and Universal since then, all by the top-notch young writer David Self, who wrote 13 Days, Road to Perdition, and the upcoming Submariner. I've only heard of Road to Perdition. Michael Mann, who everyone knows, he was supposed to be the director, but last summer he and the studio parted company with creative differences. And then there's a website, though, that's run by Nick Warby called it's www.talkgatesoffire.com. It usually has up-to-date info. It came the closest so far to being greenlit as of 2004 in the summer. David Self had finished a new script. Everybody loved it. It was out to several A-list directors, but for whatever reasons, nobody made the deal. And the project is, they're saying it's kind of too difficult to put into production because of the such a huge-ass picture. And secondly, the monumental logistics of shooting it. Only a tiny elite of directors has the track records to make a studio feel comfortable that they can handle such a huge undertaking. Ridley Scott, Wolfgang Peterson, I would say no to both those guys.
Yeah.
I would say the only people who would be qualified to do Gates of Fire would be of course, Peter Jackson could easily do it, but I know he's trying to stay away from these types of films. And then, of course,
Akira Kurosawa.
Self-evident, that would be Tanner and myself. We would have the know-how and the capability to direct this film because we know the scope and magnitude of it. So if X-Press, if you're listening right now, we love your books and we can easily translate them.
Yeah, and there wouldn't be any, you know, like, 2-week hiatuses like with the podcast. Where we just don't feel like, you know,
an indication of our work ethic. So, anyway, but yeah, I'll be out there. We should go see X-Press and so that's it, I think.
Yeah, that's it for this week.
Another one in the bag.
Yep.
See you next week. Bye.
You have been listening to This Just In, recorded on Sunday, March 5th, 2006, and distributed on Monday, March 6th, 2006. For more information about this podcast, as well as a blog and literary journal, please visit www.the-means.com.